The church I grew up in burned down 2 times in 20 years by the time I was in my mid-20s. The first time was caused by a dimmer switch that was newly installed in kind of a remodel that you see in the front of the building there. Somebody had left it on. In those days, the dimmer switches, if you leave them on, it can kind of heat up there and start a fire. That church building was completely destroyed. The next time, the one that you see on the upper right there, was destroyed by an arsonist. He walked into the sanctuary, had a can of gas, spread it all over the pews, and lit it up. A famous architect who actually did the art museum here in Portland had designed that second building, the entire one. And yet our congregation felt some of the things that Nehemiah might have felt. This church mostly needed to be rebuilt, but I remember what our pastor said. Two different pastors, both times, said the same thing. It's only a building. The church is really people who will rebuild the building. And there's times when rebuilding is needed from our own mistakes, things that we have done. There are other times when we need to rebuild because of outside forces. And that was the case in our church building. Some mistakes that we made, some that was from the outside that we didn't have control of. Either way, rebuilding, reconstruction, or you might even call it reformation, reforming our thoughts to the Bible, all of that is important when we need to move forward as people of God. The second church building was the one my wife and I were married in. And I remember thinking that our marriage is far more than the building the ceremony was performed in, right? What matters still most for my wife and I is love, is faithfulness that we have for each other. These are the ingredients that will last if we keep building or rebuilding those key ingredients. At the time of both of these church disasters, I also was thinking about how rebuilding is quite different than just building from scratch. There are usually several parts of rebuilding. You kind of have to assess the damage. You clean up what involves some kind of sorting out of what's usable, what's not. You lay out a design of what's possible to build and what it can look like. Then you can start rebuilding. It's a lot more work. It's maybe a little easier to think of the task of rebuilding when our country recalls the World Trade Center buildings brought to multiple piles of rubble on September 11th, 2001. It's hard for any of us really to know how hard this process was unless we were a part of it somehow or watched it. What was it like for anyone to watch the whole process from 9/11, 2001 to November 3rd, 2014, when the World Trade Center officially opened? Think of what rebuilding a whole city would look like as we look at Nehemiah and his task before him. Pete started us in this book last week, and we kind of pick up that story here. But let's kind of recap what has happened so far in this story of Nehemiah. We have this scroll over here that's reminding us of these key points in history. We have on the right the mountain that we're kind of trying to catch up with, the second one. And we're just a few hundred years from getting there in the story, but the Babylonians had overthrown the nation of Israel. They had destroyed the temple and the walls that surrounded Jerusalem and the temple. The families who had made up the nation of Israel had all been scattered, dispersed in various areas around that region. The period that we are looking at are found in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But there are three main men of God that were working towards getting the people of God back to the promised land from the places they were, back to this place that God had given them. Zerubbabel and Ezra, at this point, had already led two separate groups back to Jerusalem. At that same time, Nehemiah, miles away, was the third person to bring people back and help rebuild. As we learned last week, he was a cupbearer for the king Artaxerxes, the king of Persia. Recall that Nehemiah was considered a high official, in the closest circle with the king, well paid and very trusted. But he grieved for his people, the nation of Israel, God's chosen. Chosen by God to just get the message out about God and who he is. But Nehemiah had incredible vision for what could become, what could happen if these people of God are gathered back together again in this promised land after years of being scattered by the Babylonians. Nehemiah had within him what some call a holy ambition. There is a book one of my favorite authors wrote about Nehemiah called Holy Ambition. This ambition to lead this final third group back there and then rebuild the city. There is an ambition about that. But again, he was a cupbearer for the king, not a builder, and yet God would use him to rebuild. I believe this holy ambition came from three things: a love for his people, the nation of Israel. He loved that people to be the ones that God chose to get the message about who God is and what he is doing and can do in their lives. I think the second thing is that he had this holy ambition from is a desire to offer again a safe place. It was alluded to here this morning already. A safe place for his people. A protected space to once again worship God in the temple, at least with less worry of being attacked once they had a wall and once the temple was built, now the wall to protect them. On this 4th of July weekend, I also want us to note, here in the United States, we really actually don't know what it would have been like to experience what they experienced by facing this overtaking of Babylonians and then being dispersed by that group. Post 9/11, we experienced support from major nations of the world. There was not worldwide outrage when these things happened in that day, in that time. We can, however, think personally of the value of having a space where we feel safe. I've been talking off and on to a young man and what it is like to live on the streets here in Portland without a home. He told me, frankly, it's scary. It's a scary place. When he first was on the streets the first few nights, he felt scared for his life. He felt less confident. He longs to have walls and windows and doors that you can lock, as he remembers from his childhood. A safe place is what Nehemiah wanted for his people. And so that gave him this holy ambition to move forward. The third reason I think Nehemiah's holy ambition was there, it came from his desire to simply follow God. God had an overall plan, and he wanted to follow it. He wanted to follow it because of what he recalled God said to Moses back in chapter 1. If you, people of God, return to me, God speaking, and obey my commands and live by them, then even if you are exiled to the ends of the earth, I will bring you back to the place I have chosen for my name to be honored. Nehemiah saw that the people of God were ready to do just that, return to God, obey his commands, and live by them. He wanted to make this promise a reality for this chosen nation. So we have Nehemiah returning to Jerusalem with his king's appointment as the provincial governor of Judah, somewhere around 445, 444 BC. In chapter 2, we had Nehemiah surveying the damage done to the entire city in his well-known night journey around the walls, kind of assessing how things were going there and what he was going to do, verses 12 and 15 of chapter 2. So in rebuilding of anything, the first thing to note, and is the first thing in your sermon outline, is that it is always important to assess the damage first and then go from there. That's what he did in that kind of night journey around the walls. He assessed the damage and then where to go. And that really springboards into chapter 3, where we pick up the story. If you read along with me, chapter 3, 4, and 6 were our assigned. And in this chapter 3, we have Nehemiah recording specific names, recognizing those who helped rebuild the walls of the city. Actually, Paul Heinlein, if you were here last week, kind of noted that there are specific names of people he wanted to thank for helping in the rebuilding. And he named the people that had helped him with their praise band that they have. What I want to add here, though, is there are two significant words repeated 20 times in this single chapter. I want to add that to this story. He names people, but there is 20 times that two words are mentioned in this single chapter 3. What are they? Two words, 20 times. Next two. Thank you. Good job. In my Bible school teaching, if you see a repeated word, pay attention. Pay attention to the repeated words, because God's trying to get a message through those two words. He's telling us there's these named people, but they were next to each other. It was either recorded next to him, next to them, but he's telling us this named people were next to each other for this difficult task of rebuilding the city. Just notice that there are 38 individuals and 42 groups of people helping to rebuild the city walls. And each person and group was given a different part of the wall to complete. Think of what this did for the people to all be a part of the rebuilding of these walls. We need each other when there's hard things to complete. When you have a task to accomplish, a rebuilding of anything in your life, I believe we not only should start with prayer, as Nehemiah did in verses 1 and 2, but we also need others, as Nehemiah points out here in chapter 3. Hard things, difficult tasks require others to walk next to you and help you. It's really the bottom part of our coaster putting it all together, we need this togetherness. We need each other. It's a biblical principle as we think of the body of Christ. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians 12, 27 says, "All of you together are Christ's body, and each of you is a part of it." Ephesians 4, 12, Paul tells us that we are given different gifts to equip his people for these works of service, so that the body of Christ may be what? Built up. Yeah, there's that building. Nehemiah found that ownership and unity is found. Difficult tasks are best accomplished together when we find others to work next to us. Then we jump into chapter 5, and I really maybe wasn't supposed to, but I just want to give one nugget out of chapter 5. I asked Pete why he didn't want us to read chapter 5, and he said, I don't know, it just didn't seem to fit the others, but I have this one nugget for you out of chapter 5. I found this fascinating thing where Nehemiah helped. The whole chapter is about helping others, the needy in particular, in the midst of rebuilding. Nehemiah records in 5:17 that he regularly fed 150 Jewish officials at his table, besides all the visitors from other lands. I mean, he was a wealthy guy because of the king and his position, but notice how he regularly fed people from what he had. I think it's a great part of the story. Anyway, it's just a little thing in the midst there. The next Nehemiah lesson, though, for today, and you see clearly in chapter 4 and chapter 6, we see that when you do something for the Lord, know that you will face something. What is it? Obstacles. That's right. Obstacles will be a part of life, but especially in rebuilding of any kind. Entering three villains here in this true story, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. What you need to know about these guys, the Horonites and the Ammonites were two of the people groups that God had driven from the promised land when the Israelites came into this land. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem were regional governors serving under this king of Persia. Sanballat was a Horonite. Tobiah was an Ammonite. Geshem, the Arab, was most likely from the region south of Judah. These old enemies of Israel, they came back in the picture here, seeking to keep Jerusalem in ruins. These groups really did not want the walls to go back up. They wanted to have direct access to this great promised land, which used to be theirs. So you can see the tension that built there. When they came back, and these guys are trying to gather this all back, and they want to put an end to it. So we find in chapter 6 that Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem used various strategies in their attempt to disrupt. I just leave it at that. You look that up and you'll see they disrupted with these methods. In verse 2, they sought harming Nehemiah himself. In verses 5 and 6, they were intimidating him with false reports. In verse 13, deceiving him with false prophets. And then 17 through 19, this influencing the upper class of Judah, of the Israelites, and influencing them. Maybe they would talk the people that were building out of the whole thing. Think for a moment here, though, how you and I need to be aware of obstacles when it comes to rebuilding in our lives. There's outside forces that might want to harm, intimidate, deceive, influence you. But how do we combat that today? We need to learn how to face them with others, you know, alongside, next to, but with the Lord too. Putting on the full armor of God, it seems to me, as we look at the New Testament, in light of Nehemiah, Ephesians 6, it talks about not putting up a wall around us, but putting up an armor of God. It's what we have as followers of Jesus, to protect faith, the faith in our personal lives. Nehemiah wanted to protect his people and the temple with this wall, but since our body is now the temple of God, we need to protect our hearts and our minds differently. John chapter 15, in the New Testament, John writes Jesus' words where he tells us that he is the vine, we are the branches, we're to remain in him, stay connected to him. And this is the main way to protect your minds, your hearts. Stay connected to Jesus. Then Jesus goes on in verse 18 of John 15, that the world around us is going to hate us. The world around you is going to hate you. And then there's this great part of the next chapter, John 16, where Jesus tells us in verse 33, Just Jesus speaking, I have told you all of this stay connected, the world's going to hate you. I've told you all of this so that you may have peace in me, in the midst of that. Here on earth, you will have many trials and sorrows, but take heart because I, Jesus is speaking, I have overcome the world. So Jesus is telling us that if we have obstacles in the midst of life, this key is staying connected to him. I also believe that it's this armor of God part that we need to protect. So take heart. He's saying, I am way more powerful than anything in the world. So the efforts of Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem were futile for a simple reason, actually, that they were fighting against God's plan. And Nehemiah was so close to God that he knew that plan. And he like fed faith in the midst of them crumbling in the midst of the obstacles. Nehemiah's response to his enemy in chapter 6, 14, I want to note. It's something else we can learn from him. Rather than fear or worry or seeking revenge, Nehemiah took a whole different route. He took this matter to the Lord in prayer. He did that several times in this book of Nehemiah, but in 6:14 it says, remember Tobiah. He's talking to the Lord. Remember Tobiah. He names them by name. Sanballat, my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophet Noadiah and how she and the rest of the prophets, these false prophets, have been trying to intimidate us. So Nehemiah is praying for his enemies, those that persecute him. He is allowing the justice of God to reign for them, as he seems to say, remember them. And then in 6:15, chapter 6, verse 15, we kind of find this culmination. We find that because of the leadership of Nehemiah, his prayer, his assessments, showing the importance of people working next to each other, the following of God's plan, the result of all of that was the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem, shown in this picture that's an artist's rendition of what it might have looked like at that time. This rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem was completed in an amazing 52 days. As we follow Jesus today, know there will be obstacles. There'll be trials, sorrows, as Jesus said. Nehemiah faced them, we'll face them. But these points on the coaster that we call over there on the wall, it's enlarged. Look for Jesus. As you follow him, see him. Enjoy people as Nehemiah did. Do good as Nehemiah was doing and encouraging others. Become like Jesus. They were always looking for the Messiah. But we know the Messiah. Become like him, and together you and I will be Nehemiah in this day, in this time. So what is God calling you to rebuild today? Do you need to rebuild your own life? That this morning feels broken down, a life where you feel you have no peace within yourself? Do you need to rebuild a marriage that has been broken for some time? Do you need to rebuild a family that is fighting a lot? A friendship that used to be a lifeline for you but has now become broken down somehow? Do you need to rebuild a future that seems at this moment so uncertain that it seriously lacks any kind of holy ambition? What does it mean then to rebuild the walls of your life? An individual life, my life, the rebuilding of walls would be a picture of reestablishing the strength of your life. Rebuild your relationship with Jesus and with the most important people God has put in, around you in your life. But you might ask, what are the defenses in your life that have crumbled away? What are the walls that have crumbled? Like the little video at the beginning, it's like the guy didn't even notice his wall was crumbling and he's got all this mess around him. What part is crumbling for you and you may not even be noticing it? What part of the full armor of God has been missing for you? Have you become emotionally, mentally, physically, or spiritually poor or broken down? Is that the wall for you? Because we all have poverty, poor in spirit. Maybe it's physically we're challenged. We all have our challenges. Jesus desires to reach out to you and help you rebuild the walls of your life. This is the picture of the way the walls of any life, of any family, of any church, of any community, of any nation can be rebuilt into strength and purpose once again. Come back to Jesus. Come back to maybe the basic first step that Nehemiah took way back in chapter 1 when he said this in his prayer, or he's talking about coming to God in prayer. When I heard these things, the condition of the city of Jerusalem, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. This could be that this morning. You just need to come to God and weep. My dad used to say, "Big boys don't cry." He would call me a cry baby if I would. Now I realize in looking at Nehemiah, there's maybe some strength in weeping, in coming to your knees and just coming to God just as you are. Maybe you come this morning, maybe it's this afternoon, maybe it's this evening before your head hits the pillow, but come to God in prayer. And when God is calling you to rebuild, especially when it comes to your life, you would want to start with some kind of prayer. An honest, "This is where I'm at, God," prayer. Then assess what needs to be done for the rebuilding to happen. Don't forget to place yourself next to others. There's strength in that. Know there will be obstacles. Look for and seek Jesus. You will find him. You will find him if you seek him with all your heart. There is a space at the end of the sermon notes to write down where you feel you may need to do some rebuilding. You might just take time to do that, and that's just for yourself. There is an information card in your bulletin as well. And there's a place where you can check off if Jesus is calling you to rebuild a part of your life. Then there's another one of, what is Jesus calling you to rebuild today? You can fill that in. And then what part of rebuilding will need to mainly focus, you mainly need to focus on this week? Prayer, assessment, next to others, dealing with obstacles, look for and seek Jesus. And that you put in the offering baskets so that we can kind of gauge where people are at in this process and be praying for you. But the point here this morning, we have a God who will help us. Start here today, in this moment, rebuilding, reconstruct, reform your life back to a life living for Jesus and staying connected to him. Amen.